Thank you, Mr. Decapite. Yes, it is exciting. We're only a couple days away from the feast. Yesterday morning, I walked out to go to the truck before I go to work, and I noticed the air was starting to get crisp. I don't know about you, but me, I don't care where I am in the world, I can tell, you can feel the feast coming on. The temperature changes, the smell of the air changes. I don't think the smell has quite changed yet for me, but it is starting to get crisp, and it definitely does feel like the feast. But before we get to the feast, we do have to celebrate the Day of Atonement. Now, the Day of Atonement is obviously, as we know, a very, very significant holy day where we look to Christ's atonement sacrifice for us, Satan being put away for 1,000 years, or put away, period, forever, actually. But when, but sometimes it's really hard, isn't it, to concentrate on the significance of Day Atonement when we're fasting? Most of the time, I can't help it, but I'm thinking about my stomach. And when I did drink coffee, and I do drink some, not as much as I used to, I dreaded those splitting headaches. And when the kids were little, I used to tease with them, tell them, we need to practice up for Days of Atonement. And they would act like they were going to die, but they didn't realize that they weren't going to die. But when I was growing up as a kid, there was a guy in our congregation back home who felt like he wasn't afflicting his soul enough by fasting one day. And he would literally fast 3 days to afflict his soul. Now, personally, I think that's going a little bit overboard. But one day is all required. Anyway, through all of this, there is one aspect that we don't talk about very much that is associated with Day of Atonement that me personally, I feels like it's just out of place. It just doesn't feel like it fits. So today I would like to talk about the Jubilee and talk about the significance of the Jubilee and how it definitely fits in with the Day of Atonement. So first of all, let's start by going to Leviticus chapter 25. And we're going to be spending most of the time in Leviticus chapter 25. But the first couple chapters, or the first couple verses, talk about the Sabbath or the seventh year rest. But we're going to start in Leviticus 25 and in verse 8. And we're going to read through verse 14. And you shall count 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, and the times of the 7 Sabbaths of the year shall be to you 49 years. Then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to be sound on the 10th day of the 7th month on the Day of Atonement. You shall make a trumpet to sound throughout all your land. And you shall consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all of its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you shall return to his family. The 50th year shall be a jubilee to you, and in it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows on its own accord, nor gather the grapes of the untended vine. And verse 12, for it is a jubilee, it shall be holy to you, and you shall eat its produce of the field. In this year of the jubilee, each one of you shall return to his possessions. And then jump down to verse 17, therefore you shall not oppress one another, but you shall fear your God, for I am the Lord your God. Here's a little synopsis of what the Jubilee actually is, and we'll go into more detail in the chapter, but the thing that sticks out to me, first of all, is the term Jubilee. It's called Jubilee, and it starts on Day of Atonement, a day when it's hard not to be miserable. But I went to dictionary.com, and it defines Jubilee as an occasion of rejoicing and celebration, like in a 50-year anniversary. Additionally, We also read back in, in verse 10. Yeah, we read in verse 10 about it being about declaring liberty. Now, liberty is also a state of being free of oppression. Now, that is just a synopsis, and that's partly why, to me, it doesn't fit with atonement. But before we get into all that, let's just do a quick rundown more on some of the interesting points that are associated with the Jubilee. Now, in Leviticus 25, and we'll start in verse 18. So you shall observe my statutes and keep my judgments and perform them, and you shall dwell in the land in safety. And in verse 19, then the land will yield its fruit and will eat your fill and dwell there in safety. Verse 20, and if you say, what shall we eat in the seventh year, since we shall not sow nor gather our produce? Very good question. And in verse 21, then I will command my blessing on you in the sixth year, and it will bring forth produce enough for 3 years, and you shall sow in the eighth year and eat old produce until the ninth, until it has come in, and you shall eat the old harvest. Bottom line, we do not touch the farmland. All the farmland we see out here in Georgia, all the farmland we see in the Midwest, it will lay fertile. It will lay quiet. Nobody will be reaping, running the big tractors, but there will be enough. It will be enough for 3 whole years. I was walking through Walmart the other day, and I was still just amazed on how much, even with, you know, suffering from COVID and limitations that we're having, there's still so much. How many choices of milk do you have? I mean, all kinds. But anyway, that's the real important one is one we're going to come to next. And actually, before I get into that next point, the next interesting point is that the one thing that I don't believe we talk about, or the reason we don't talk about the Jubilee, is because it's really hard to translate what is talked about here in Leviticus 25 into our 21st century life. The Jubilee is associated with inheritance. I'm a boy from Southern California. Inheritance means absolutely nothing to me. I'll tell you how much I'm going to get probably for my inheritance. No criticism of my father. Probably absolutely nothing. Will I get land passed down? I don't even know where our family land is, if it even exists. Inheritance means nothing to me. And additionally, our economic system is completely different today than it was back then. One thing that drives our economic system today is the debtor system, credit card. They didn't have the same credit card / debt system that we have today. But anyway, let's go to the second interesting point in Leviticus 25 and in verse 23. The land shall be not sold permanently, for the land is mine, and for you are strangers and sojourners with me. And in all the land of your possessions, you shall grant redemption of the land. For one of your brethren, in verse 25, becomes poor, and he has sold some of his possessions, and if his redeeming relatives come to redeem it, then he may redeem it, what his brother has sold. Or if the man has no one to redeem it, but he himself comes and is able to redeem it, then let him count the years since the sale and restore the remainder to the man to whom he sold it, that he may return to his possessions. And in verse 28, and if he is not able to have to come to restore it to himself, then what was sold shall remain in the hand of him who bought it until the year of the Jubilee. And in the Jubilee it shall be released, and he shall return to his possession. Now, the significance here is, and I was reading through the book of Joshua, God is very specific in Joshua 13 and on that he actually gives land to each one of the families and each one of the tribes. They are specifically given those, and they are not allowed to sell it. Now, then, like I said, I'm a product of Southern California. I have no concept what inheritance land is like, and I really didn't understand it or experience it until I got here. When we all moved here, I met a guy from Marshallville, just a couple miles south. He let me hunt on his land with him. And in the course of conversation, I asked him, how long has your family been on this land? And he says, I don't know. It was, I believe, my great-grandmother's property. Do you realize, if you've done through the math, that was before the Civil War. So as far as I'm concerned, that's probably as close to inheritance land that I will personally ever experience. But the bottom line is, if you sell the land because you become poor, and we'll talk about that become poor in just a couple minutes, but if you sell the land because you become poor, it's not a sale. So we don't think of it as a sale. It's more like a lease. And the lease price is based upon the number of years to the Jubilee. Now, there are some exceptions to this. In verse 29, and if a man sells a house in a walled city, then he may redeem it within a whole year that is sold. Within a full year, he may redeem it. But if he does not redeem it within the space in the full year, then the house in the walled city shall belong permanently to him who bought it. And that's the thing. I grew up in Southern California, in Los Angeles. I think Los Angeles would be considered a walled city. So when I sold my house, it was gone. I think if I sell my house in Warren Robins, that could probably be considered a walled city. It's gone. But down in verse 31, however, the house of villages which have no walls around them shall be counted as fields of the country. They may be redeemed, and they shall be released in the Jubilee. Houses and villages, go back. So like I said, it's more like a lease as opposed to a sale. Now the third interesting point that's brought out in Leviticus 25 has to do with slavery, or as some of us know, indentured servants. And in verse 35, and if one of your brethren becomes poor, there's that expression again, and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him like a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. Take no usury or interest from him, but fear your God, that your brother may live with you. And in verse 37, you shall not lend to him your money for usury, nor lend him your food for profit. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. And in verse 39, and if one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave. But in verse 40, as a hired servant, as a sojourner, he shall be with you and shall serve you unto the year of the Jubilee. And then he shall depart from you, he, his children with him, and he shall return to his own family, and he shall return to his possessions of his fathers. Again, in verse 42, for you are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. They shall not be sold as slaves. And then as an additional note, in Deuteronomy 15, it talks about releasing of servants, releasing of the bond servants. When these servants are released, you shall release them with gifts. Basically, you are to pay them. They are not to leave you as empty-handed. Now, an interesting comment here is at least three times in this chapter, in verse 25, 35, and in verse 39, it says, And if one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor. That is a very interesting concept. When I was a younger guy, I had a friend who told me she had about $20,000 in credit card debt. Was she in debt? Was she poor? Sure. But did she become poor? The answer is no, she did not. What she couldn't do was control her spending habits. You could actually even argue the fact that it was envy or covetousness, and she was purchasing things, purchasing items, clothes, cars, whatever it was that put her into this $20,000 plus credit card debt. It was not, she just couldn't control it. That did not make her poor. Now, on the other hand, today with the things that we're seeing with, you know, COVID-19, cancer, becoming poor usually, or not usually, always is associated with a tragedy. Do you lose a job? Do you lose a house? I was told, and I could get the stats if I had to, that one of the things that makes people go bankrupt more than anything else is cancer treatment. I will tell you, just from a side note, with my little cancer treatment, would you believe it? The medical guys billed my insurance company for, it was on the tune of like $90,000. $90,000. Where would I be if I had to pay for that? I'd be living under the bridge over here with my family. I would have become poor. What are some of the, like I say, some of the other examples? Death of a spouse. We had a friend years ago that had a fish tank that fell over. And when they went to catch it to try to keep it from falling over, it shattered and it put a serious cut in their arm. Well, unfortunately, they didn't have any insurance to pay for it. So they literally became poor. That is actually what it refers to. Now, there are three lessons here that we can actually, or three lessons we can take away from this, from the Jubilee. First of all, the Jubilee prevents families from losing their inheritance forever and prevents Israelites from remaining in slavery or as bondservants forever. Now, if I had to pay my $90,000 surgery bill, would I ever be able to get out of it? No. Unfortunately, a lot of college students now are racking up $100,000, $200,000 or more dollars in college loan debt. How on earth will they ever pay that off? So you begin to see with that particular one, the Jubilee is exciting because you know the term of debt is coming to an end. The second point is it prevents the government or others from taking your family land. Let's turn over to Ezekiel, please. Ezekiel chapter 46. Kind of an interesting verse that's buried in here. Ezekiel 46, and in verse 16, we'll read from 16 to 18. Thus says the Lord God, if princes gives a gift to some of his inheritance to any of his sons, it shall belong to his sons. It is their possession by inheritance. But if he gives a gift of some of his inheritance to one of his servants, it shall be his until the year of liberty. What's the year of liberty? The Jubilee. After which it shall return to the prince, for his inheritance shall belong to his sons, it shall become theirs. In verse 18, moreover, the prince shall not take away or take any of the people's inheritance by evicting them from their property. He shall provide an inheritance for his sons from his own property, so that none of my people may be scattered from his property. Now, the last note that I think is important and is probably, in my mind, the most important of all. The Jubilee, though it may sound like it, is not a time of cancellation of debt. Now, we look at it in our 21st century economic system. I've heard it said throughout the church, all debt will be canceled. That can't be true. That is not true. If I go out and spend $20,000, $30,000 on that good-looking Tacoma that I want to buy, the Jubilee comes rolling around, I still own that Tacoma, don't I? Which means I still owe Toyota whatever the balance of that loan is, do I not? If they cancel the debt, that would be either one of two things. One, goodwill on Toyota, or it would be stealing, because I would be getting this $30,000, $40,000 Tacoma at a fraction of what the sale price is. It's associated not, and see, this is where the translation from what's described here in Leviticus 25 and how we see it today, how it's hard to translate. Let's see, where was it? But what it is talking about is, again, it goes back to in Leviticus 25, like I mentioned, the three times where it mentions, when you become poor. If you become poor, the land is sold at the value based on the number of years to the Jubilee. Now, the interesting thing about this is, when the Jubilee comes, the debt is paid. And I like the better expression. I read it in an article about the Jubilee, and what the author said was, at the Jubilee, the debt is not canceled. The debt is paid in full. The debt is paid in full. Now, interesting comment, and it's actually a sad one at that. There has never been one instance or one recorded instance of Israel ever keeping the Jubilee. And as that matter, there was no example of Israel ever keeping the sabbatical rest mentioned in verses 1 through 5. So, why is the Jubilee so different, so significant when it comes to the Day of Atonement? Well, four times in Leviticus 25, and we mentioned it a couple times, and sorry, I didn't even have it, but we've already read it a couple times. God reminds us of one thing. We were slaves in Egypt, and I redeemed you. I brought you out of sin. That was one of the things. And then the whole other theme, and we read it throughout the entire passages we were reading, the Jubilee centers around liberty, freedom, and redemption. Now, we are very, very familiar with the symbolism of Day of Atonement, are we not? We have Christ, the one goat that is sacrificed and is an atonement for all people, and the individual that was responsible for sins, he's cast out forever. So do you catch the symbolisms here? And the symbolism here and why the trumpet for Jubilee is blown is very critical, Because Christ is paying our debt of sin. He's not canceling out our debt to sin, but he's paying our debt to sin in full by his total sacrifice. Now, another interesting point, too, by the way, do you know that Christ actually already has blown that trumpet declaring the Jubilee? Let's go to Luke. Luke chapter 4. Luke chapter 4, this is the chapter where Jesus, my title says, Jesus begins his Galilean ministry. And we'll start in verse 16. Luke 4 and verse 16. So he came to Nazareth, he Christ, where he had been brought up. And as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and he stood up and read. And he was handed the book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, and in verse 18, the Spirit of Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, to recover the sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, and to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. And in verse 20, then he closed the book and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all who were in the synagogue were fixed on him. And in verse 21, he began to say to them, today this scripture is fulfilled. So what was Christ doing? Christ was declaring, I'm here. My sacrifice is the time for liberty for all. I am paying your debt to sin in full. In full. Now that begs a question. There is that elephant in the room that we definitely have to talk about, that we definitely have to ask. If atonement is really an exciting time of liberty, debt paid in full, then why on earth do I have to afflict my soul and fast because it makes me miserable? Why is that? The answer is quite simple. Though Satan was the cause of sin, we have always been willing accomplices, have we not? How often has Satan had to influence us to commit sin? Sometimes he does, sometimes he doesn't. But, let's see, where do I want to jump to? Jeremiah. I'll read one verse here in Jeremiah. Jeremiah 17. Very, very familiar verse. Jeremiah 17 and verse 9. The heart, our carnal heart, is deceptive above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I, the Lord, search the heart. I test the mind, even to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doings. So, Why do we fast on atonement? As a reminder, though Christ atones for us and pays our debt to sin in full, it's a reminder to us that we, as carnal human beings, played a part. It's that simple. It's that significant. Atonement, tied with Jubilee, reminds us that it's a day of freedom. It's a day of liberty. It's a day of atonement, thanks to God, or thanks to Jesus Christ's sacrifice. The atonement once for all. Our debt to sin has been paid in full. So, throughout this day of sacrifice, when Christ came the first time, he blew the trumpet of the Jubilee, declaring our liberty to sin. So we are now free, no longer slaves to sin. Our debt to sin has not been canceled, but it has been paid in full.